Case number 13-3034, United States of America v. Maurice Williams, appellant. Mr. Smith for the appellant, Mr. Coleman for the appellee.
Mr. Smith.
May it please the court, my name is Greg Smith, and I'm the appointed counsel for the appellant, Maurice Williams. Mr. Williams' conviction and sentence should be vacated by this court for three reasons. First, the government didn't adequately justify its warrantless stops and seizures. Second, the government improperly vouched and shifted the burden during rebuttal closing at trial. And third, the district court wrongly refused to consider state sentencing disparities before imposing its 63-month sentence. First, the Fourth Amendment. On both the October 21st, 2011 warrantless stop and the February 1st, 2012 warrantless search, the government failed to establish a viable exception to the warrant requirement. It was their burden to justify a warrantless stop, and this court's review is de novo. On the October 21st stop, all we really have is an officer's statement that Mr. Williams wasn't wearing a seatbelt, even though he was. Judge Howell herself found that he was.
Also found that the officer was credible who testified that he thought he was not wearing a seatbelt.
Your Honor, what she found was
That's a yes or no answer. You can explain it after you answer.
Yes.
Didn't she find he was credible?
She did, Your Honor.
Okay. Isn't credibility for the district judge?
Well, she found he was credible, but she didn't find him convincing. And what she did find with my client was he was credible and convincing.
Do you really think that's the line we should draw in deciding whether we affirm the credibility determination of the district judge?
Your Honor, I guess what I would say is this.
Does she have to say credible and convincing? Why isn't credible enough if credibility is for the district judge?
Because subjective good faith is not enough.
I read that in your brief. And I don't know where you get that from today.
Well, I get it from the Glover opinion, Your Honor, which specifically says, it's a D.C. Circuit case, and it says the officer's good subjective good faith belief is insufficient. That's what the Glover case says.
What was the context of that?
Well, it was in the context of, in the Glover case, they were looking for Mr. Mathis, and they found Mr. Glover. But the court said that officer's subjective good faith belief alone is insufficient. And that's really all we have here.
But didn't she say, the district court said that the officer's belief was objectively reasonable, not that it was in subjective good faith. I'm quoting from her opinion. JA 62. Objectively reasonable. And that's what we said was required in United States versus Hill. And that's what the Supreme Court said was good enough in Illinois versus Rodriguez.
Well, here's what Illinois versus Rodriguez said. It did allow some room for mistakes, you're correct. But it said, quote, but the mistakes must be those of reasonable men acting on facts leading sensibly to their conclusions of probability.
But
here there are no facts.
But don't we really have two kinds of facts here? On the one hand, the district judge credited Mr. Williams that he was wearing his seatbelt. And at the same time, she credited the officer that he perceived Mr. Williams to not be wearing his seatbelt. And so one is the officer's actual perception at the time, and the other is the state of the seatbelt. And so there isn't really a conflict between those two things, is there, if we acknowledge that people reasonably can make mistakes in observation. And then the question is, if I'm right about that, then how do we treat it?
Your Honor, I just think that the district judge was trying to, she was seeking to reconcile the irreconcilable. I mean, let me try to back up real quickly. My client said that when the officer passed by, he lifted his seatbelt and showed it to him. How do you reconcile it, him turning, showing that he has a seatbelt on, with the officer saying he looked over?
There actually could be quite a number of ways, but it's not ours to reconcile anyway, is it? And the district judge says that the officer was credible. Can we second guess her on that? I mean, one of the ways you reconcile it is the officer wasn't looked at exactly that second. If you looked at him before and after and didn't see the time he lifted the seat. I mean, that's one of the ways you reconcile it. But we don't have to speculate like that, do we?
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully, I think that the court needs to, I don't think it's sufficient for the district court, in essence, to say, I'm unwilling to brand him a liar. That doesn't get you there. That's not sufficient. I think that the court, as it Rodriguez says, you have to look at whether there were acts leading sensibly to the conclusions of problem. What were the acts? What were the facts?
Glover case? Is that in your brief?
No, it was a supplemental authority cited by the government.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know what you're talking about now.
But I do think you have to go beyond just a finding that she was unwilling to brand him a liar. You have to look at the facts.
And she credited him. It wasn't that she was, I mean, you make it sound like she's trying to be nice because he's a police officer, but she credited his testimony, and she carefully followed the direction of this court in Hill that she should make findings about opportunity to observe, which she did, and determined that he was testifying credibly when he said he saw your client not wearing his seatbelt.
Well, she didn't say that his repeated – I submit that she looked and said that the process was reasonable rather than his belief was reasonable. She never explained why he got it wrong. This court is left to guess as to why he got it wrong. And I think if it was the government's burden, then she needed to find why he got it wrong, and she never said. And it, not just why he got it wrong, but why he got it wrong repeatedly despite supposed good looks. He never admitted a mistake.
Let me ask you about the argument on both sides seems to be a legal argument about what's required, subjective, objective, understandable mistake or not. Are you making a clearly erroneous argument? Are you arguing that her factual finding as to what the officer perceived was clearly erroneous?
Your Honor, I'm not saying that the findings were wrong. I'm saying there was an absence of findings. So it's not a clearly erroneous factual findings situation. I'm saying she failed to find why he got it wrong. She failed to find that his mistakes were reasonable, even though they were repeated mistakes. She never addressed the fact that he supposedly made a mistake when he first got in the car, and then he saw him later and he made the same mistake again. Both of those mistakes were reasonable. She never addressed those. So I submit that at a minimum, this court needs to remand.
And where is she required to go further than she did in finding why he got it wrong? What's your best authority on that?
Your Honor, I think that it is the essence of meeting the government's burden when you're claiming that I don't think it's sufficient to simply say in a conclusory fashion that the mistakes were objectively reasonable without explaining why they were objectively reasonable. I think that the government has to explain why, and particularly when she's relying. She did explain that the color differential was supposedly similar, but there was no testimony about that. It was made up from whole cloth that there was no color differential between them. In fact, in the court's own opinion, she acknowledges, and this is at JA 61, nor could he, meaning Thompson, nor could he recall the color of the defendant's clothing, the interior of the car, or whether those colors were contrasting. So there's no facts supporting her conclusion. Yes, she said it, but there were no facts explaining why he got it wrong. All she looked at was the process, and I submit that's not enough. Understand that there's some resistance to this, so let me move to the February 1st search, if I might. With respect to the February 1st search, again, there was no warrant. Tompkins subsequently removed from the evidence bag my client's key fob, which had been confiscated earlier at the time of the arrest, and then he moved it and activated it without consent or knowledge of my client.
So was that issue raised in the district court? There's no. I have the, I guess it's a JA-42, the motion to suppress. There's no mention of a key fob at all. Right.
There is not a specific mention.
Not a general or a specific mention.
You're correct, Your Honor. I wasn't counsel then, but right. But I would say that what was raised, which I think was found sufficient, even in the case that the government cited, was that he raised a general motion that this was a warrantless stop or warrantless search, which shifted the burden. I think
that might go to the question of going into the car. But there's no argument about a warrantless search of a key fob. There's a warrantless search of a car. And so maybe you could raise the question of whether it was legitimate to go into the car. But the key fob is a different matter. And normally we would consider that waived, even if you give you the benefit of doubt and call it forfeited and plain error, what makes the, I mean, they arrested the person, they seized something that was on his body, therefore incident to arrest. What prevents them from pushing the button on the key fob?
I submit that it's a search. It had an investigatory purpose, and under the Jones case, that's sufficient when we're talking about
electronic evidence. But it was seized incident to arrest, so what, you can search it. What?
The car was not seized incident
to arrest. I'm not talking about the car. I'm talking about the key fob.
The fob was in, and activating it, just like you can seize a computer, but you can't go in the, you can seize a computer incident to arrest if I'm holding it, but you can't go into the computer without a warrant. You can't activate it.
But that shows you something inside the computer. Pressing the key fob showed you something that was in public. Showed you all it did was show where the car was.
It showed the connection between my client and a car. I submit it was an effort, an investigatory effort by this officer to test my client's statement that he'd been dropped off.
Well, that may well be that. But
and
that
that's an investigatory purpose.
That doesn't make it an unlawful search. There are lots of investigatory purposes that are not unlawful searches.
Well, I submit that under the case law that because there was an investigatory purpose, it constitutes a Fourth Amendment.
Well, we don't have any cases in our circuit on key fobs.
No cases in this circuit.
But there are cases in other circuits, and most of them say that it's not a search. It's a split, but most of them say it's not. So it can't be plain error. Right? Under that theory, it can't be plain error. So if you accept, which I take it you don't, that this wasn't raised sufficiently below, then it's not plain error. That would be right?
What I would suggest, if that's the case, is that the court remand for a finding on ineffectiveness, which we did mention.
Okay. But so assume for the moment that it was okay to push the key fob. From that spot on, is there anything illegal about the search of the car?
Not that I'm going to argue today, Your Honor.
Okay.
All right. Let me move quickly.
Back to your citation of Jones, you don't have the mosaic here that you had in Jones, do you?
No, understood, Your Honor. That's a GPS case. It's a different circumstance, but the standards is
Jones dealt with publicly visible movements, and at least apparently, or at least arguably, it only became a search because of the mosaic of combining the various movements. So that Jones is not really important at all, is it?
Well, Your Honor, I think that they say in the context of electronic searches, because it's a new technology and a new situation for the courts to address, that the standard, what you should be looking at in determining whether it's a Fourth Amendment issue, is whether there was an investigatory purpose. I think there was here. He was testing my client's statement.
Do you have language from Jones that says that would apply absent the mosaic?
It doesn't specifically say that.
Right.
All right.
Or generally. Well, I guess maybe generally, but it's certainly not specifically.
Given my limited time, let me quickly cover the last two issues. With respect to the closing arguments on the vouching and burden shifting during rebuttal, they told the jury that, in essence, these police officers had to have a vendetta or would lie to save their jobs. I don't have a lot to add here. You're going to decide what you want to do. But I do think it's troubling, and this court should find troubling. The government is claiming here that this wasn't error at all. This U.S. Attorney's Office has been admonished repeatedly on this issue. This is obviously, plainly, improper argument, as they should know, and it affected my client's main defense of credibility. Even if it might be harmless on some of the counts, it was absolutely not on the crack cocaine conviction, which is the only conviction that caused him a mandatory minimum. But the court, I submit, has a purpose, a reason to get involved here and make very clear that this type of activity should not be raised in closing arguments. Finally, on the sentencing, there is no question. The district court said it could not consider this factor as a basis for a downward variance. This is a pure legal issue.
Can I ask you, there's a 2012 opinion of this court, United States versus Washington. It's not mentioned by either side. It seems to me to completely resolve this question. Are you familiar with it?
I'm not, Your Honor.
So it's a case where it seems to me anyway this exact issue was raised, and where the court said that D.C. versus federal disparities can't be considered under A6. So
I might request an opportunity to submit a supplemental briefing. I appreciate it. Reserved.
Before the government gets started, are you familiar with that case?
No, Your Honor, at least I'm not.
Okay, I'll give you both the sites, 670 F3rd 1321, brought by your office against Russell Washington, United States versus Russell Washington. Seems to me that the same issue was raised, that is, the same issue that was originally raised in Clark, and then Washington says Clark's still good law post-Booker. So I don't think it's worth discussing at oral argument, given that it looks like there's a case on point, but both sides should feel free to file something by the end of tomorrow, responding as to your views of that case. Either of my colleagues have further questions, that's fine. Okay, in that case, I'll go on to the other three issues.
Very well, Your Honor. May I please the Board? Nicholas Coleman for the United States. If I could begin by addressing what I think was the central issue in appellant's argument here today, and that's the October stop of appellant's car. I think it is clear that this Court and the Supreme Court have held that an officer's mistakes of fact, mistaken observations, may give rise to Fourth Amendment cause to conduct a stop, provided the officer's belief is objectively reasonable. And Judge Howell here made that finding. She found that it was objectively reasonable. She credited the officer as to his observation, and she found that it was objectively reasonable based on his opportunity to observe it and the fact that he had looked into the car, not just when appellant got into the car, but also while he was driving alongside.
This may be more of a quibble with our own decision in Hill, but it strikes me that opportunity to observe might not make a mistake of fact more objectively reasonable, but in fact would cut the other way. So having an opportunity to observe, for example, saying, I saw this and I was only 50 feet away, you know, makes it more credible. But saying, I looked at him and I got up close to him and I looked at him, and then to say, you still were mistaken, in a way it raises a question about the plausibility of what the officer's saying. So I guess the logic of opportunity to observe as something that meets the test of objective reasonableness or understandable mistake is a little puzzling to me, and I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it certainly is correct that one could imagine where if a fact finder has to resolve two competing claims about what was true or what was not, that if you found that a fact was untrue and the other person was saying it was true, if they were really close up, if they were really staring at it, that you might have a hard time saying, how could you possibly credit the officer? But then again, I think two things distinguish this case from that situation. First, Judge Howell did have the opportunity to observe Officer Tompkins' demeanor, to listen to him on the stand, to hear him being cross-examined about this observation, and she found him credible. And I think she also, she posited, you know, that there could be a way, at least one way that she could see, where that perfectly honest and objectively reasonable mistake could have been made. I don't think, it's not always possible to be able to get inside a person's head and to be able to explain exactly why they could have made a mistake in looking at something. But given that she credited his testimony, having heard him, talk about what he saw, and determined that this wasn't the kind of sort of just scientifically impossible situation where, you know, you just couldn't believe that somebody, you know, would honestly be able to look at that and say the seatbelt wasn't there, that's enough. And I think Hill establishes that that's really what the judge needs to do. And I think she cited Hill. She tried to apply what this court had said in Hill in this case, and I think that was sufficient to sustain.
In some ways, this seems like a garden variety case. She credited the officer. What more do we need? She found objectively reasonable. But in another way, it seems actually quite different from a lot of the mistake of fact cases, in which by the time you read the description of the facts as found by the district court, you understand why the mistake was made. This person and that person looked very similar. The officers cased the outside of the house and were looking at the third floor and had sort of spatial reasons to believe that the apartment covered the whole floor, or coming up to the carryout next to the bar and seeing someone, you know, with a brown paper bag drinking there and people not buying alcohol there. Like, there are understandable reasons for the mistake. And here we don't really have that. We really have a bare credibility finding. Is that wrong?
Well, I don't think that it's necessary. It is true that in some cases, like Your Honor has explained, it's immediately obvious why the mistake was made physically. In other words, why did the officer perceive what the officer said he saw? But I don't think that has to be the case in every case. And I don't think it's always going to be possible to know in every situation why somebody, when they looked at a situation, could have misperceived something. One thing I do want to make clear, appellant's counsel has argued that the judge, I guess inferentially, must have credited appellant's testimony that he lifted up and showed the seatbelt. She didn't specifically credit that testimony. She noted that he had some
testimony and did not exempt that part.
She didn't exempt that part, but she also didn't, when she said she credited him that he was wearing the seatbelt, I don't think that you can necessarily draw that she credited that aspect of his testimony, which, you know, one might think that particularly the way that he gave it during the hearing looked a little bit like post hoc rationalization. For him to explain that for some reason he believed that the officers were specifically looking, even before they stopped him, for his seatbelt. But it's not clear whether she credited that aspect of his testimony or not. She also certainly didn't address the question of whether or not the officer was looking at the precise moment when he was showing the seatbelt, assuming that he did so.
She also didn't inquire onto the color of the shirt or further into circumstances that might have created a more factually understandable mistake. She just hypothesized it could have been this. Is that right?
I think it's because she did not view it as being necessary for her to establish exactly why the officer made the mistake that he did, and I don't think that it's necessary for the judge to do so. And I think because, again, it's very hard to try to sort of get inside somebody's head and be able to, you know, explain, you know, even, let's say, neurologically, why their eyes wouldn't have seen it in this case. I think what she was trying to say here was that it certainly wasn't in the realm of scientific impossibility, where it would have been impossible for him to have looked in there and not seen the seatbelt.
So under Hill versus California, when the Supreme Court says that it's not enough that it be a subjective, good faith, actual belief, it has to be understandable. The officer's mistake has to be understandable. And what in this case fulfills the requirement of the mistake being understandable?
Well, I think the mistake in Hill, which was very similar to the mistake made in Garner, was of a different. It's addressing a different step, I guess, in the process here. There, the question was the officers, you know, or the arresting agents were looking for a person under a warrant, and they believed that they looked at the person in front of them, who they were going to end up searching. In Garner was the actual defendant in the case, and I think in Hill it was somebody else, but they recovered evidence then used against the actual defendant. They looked at the person and said, this looks like the person described in the warrant. And there, the observations that they made were essentially taken as a given. In other words, I observed this about the person. He had a mustache. He had his hair matched the color of the person described in the warrant. And those observations, you know, are, as this court has held in Sutherland, those are the findings of fact, and they're subject to clear error review. Now, the inferences that you draw from those observations, that really gets into whether or not the belief is objectively reasonable. And there, what the courts determined in both Hill and Garner was that, I'm sorry, Your Honor. What page in Garner?
What case is it?
That's the one which the government cited in its claim.
Isn't it Glover?
Glover. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes.
I'm confused enough just at Glover.
My apologies, Your Honor. No, that's correct. It's Glover. My apologies. But I think in both of those cases, both Hill and in Glover, the question was, once you had these observations as a given, was it then reasonable for the officers to conclude that this was the person? That was a bit more complicated than the decision the officer had to make here. Here it's just a one-step observation. The person is either wearing a seatbelt or not. If they are not wearing the seatbelt, then the traffic violation has occurred. And here, I think, you know, the officer's observation, looking in twice and determining that the driver here was not wearing his seatbelt, certainly gave him the reasonable suspicion required to conduct what's essentially an investigatory stop. I mean, it doesn't mean you're necessarily going to get the citation.
So in a sense, you're saying that the understandable aspect, or that the factual conclusions be objectively reasonable or understandable, even if mistaken, is really applicable only in a case where there are, on the fact side, inferences to be drawn. So there are observations which are subject to clearly erroneous and, you know, your basic credibility determinations and clearly erroneous review. And then there are inferences that the officer makes that are factual inferences about what's happening in the world. And that's all before you even get into the objective reasonableness of the legal determination in terms of probable cause.
I think that's correct, except that I think the inferences that you draw really does start to, that starts to bleed into the question of whether or not the mistake was objectively reasonable. So that's why in Glover and Hill, you know, the question was, you know, was it objectively reasonable to think this person is the person sought under the warrant? I have a certain number, as the officer, I have a certain number of observations I'm making about this person's appearance. I know this is what I know about the person's appearance from the warrant. There's enough of a match here that I'm going to make the arrest. And that really is a question of, was it objectively reasonable? But the question of exactly what
did you... As a factual matter. Because you don't really have... The magistrate issuing the warrant has made the reasonableness determination on the law side. So that's all taken care of in... a warrant type of case.
Yes, that's true. I think the objective reasonableness is true. I mean, it's a separate inquiry, but it is more of an inference-based inquiry, inferences from the observations. I think in this case, the judge, having heard Officer Tompkins' testimony, credited his testimony and determined that it was reasonable for him to have drawn this conclusion because he didn't just get a fleeting look. I think, the issue in Hill that this court was concerned with when it remanded was it did the officers really get a good enough look that they could rely on their conclusion that there was no VIN number on the license plate? And so that's really what the court wanted to find out. Ultimately, what the court said was it doesn't matter whether or not the VIN is actually there on the license plate. And so I think here, Judge Howell carefully tried to apply the criteria this court approved in Hill, and I believe she did so, and this court should affirm that judgment. Turning to the question of the February search, I think it's the under United States v. Mitchell, this issue is waived. I mean, appellant simply did not mention below, even after hearing Officer Tompkins' testimony about pressing the key pop, never mentioned and never asked the court to rule on whether pressing the key fob was a search, and that really results in the issue being waived. And certainly, even if this court were to entertain it as being merely forfeited, he can't show plain error given the lack of...
Given their error at all.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I think it's just not error at all, but certainly not plain error. And so I think that certainly ends the inquiry. Again, in light of these factual findings that the judge has made.
Could you say something quickly about the vouching and closing argument?
Yes, Your Honor. We would respectfully disagree with the argument made by appellant that this was just obviously improper argument. Here, government counsel was responding to repeated claims.
Well, let's start with the statement. Why would these officers jeopardize lengthy careers and lie about individuals they don't know? That is approximately the same statement as in Boyd. Is that right?
It's similar. I think in this case here, where you have, the government here, and I think the jury would have understood, the government here was responding to repeated and very forceful attacks on the credibility of these officers, saying that they were, in fact, making this up, that they were lying right there, that they've been lying, as the jury could see, in other words, supposedly under oath. And so I don't think that in context here that was...
Why is it different in Boyd? The The case that you rely on to say it's different is Hall, right? Mm-hmm. But in Hall, what was said by the other side was that the officers had a stake in the outcome of the trial and that they wouldn't want to jeopardize their career, that they had that concern about their careers gave them a motive for perjury. And the response was, no, a concern about their careers would have given them a motive not to lie. I didn't see anything in the defense counsel's argument that's anywhere near what was said in Hall. Certainly permissible for defense counsel to challenge the credibility of witnesses on the other side. If the rule is that whenever they do that, you can make this vouching argument, then you can always do that, because officer credibility is always at issue.
Obviously, officer credibility certainly can always be at issue, but I think also, you know, government counsel doesn't just have to sit back and not come to the defense of its witnesses.
Maybe they can say there's no evidence that they're lying. That's one thing. The specific problem that was pointed to in these cases is the argument that they would jeopardize their career by lying, because there's no evidence one way or the other about that. That's the specific thing that the court found to be error. And it seems to me you've done this again, and I understand there's an argument about not being prejudicial error, but I would hope that the U.S. Attorney's Office in their training would bring to the attention of assistant U.S. attorneys these two cases. Even Hall did not say it was an error, just says it wasn't prejudicial error.
Yes, sir.
So the government risks its case every time closing argument it commits error in the hope that it might not be prejudicial error. It seems like something quite appropriate, and whether you can get by one more time or not, if I were you, I wouldn't risk it.
Well, we certainly take very seriously our obligation not to vouch and put in, essentially suggest that there's evidence out there that hasn't been presented to the jury that the jury can't evaluate in evaluating the credibility of its witnesses. I think this one fleeting remark certainly, you know, doesn't rise to the level of something that's, you know, so improper and so certainly not prejudicial that a conviction should be reversed. I think here, you know, government counsel was trying to respond to, you know, attacks on the officer's credibility, which were really the heart of the defense in this case, and the heart of both defendants at that trial. You know, obviously, even if this one stray remark might, on a cold transcript, be read to somehow be implying something about, you know, what happens to officers when they lie, et cetera, I don't think that the jury here would have taken it necessarily in that light. And I think certainly in light of the judge's instructions that, you know, the jurors were the ultimate judges of witness credibility, that they shouldn't treat officers' testimony any differently than that of any other witnesses, that, you know, the jury was unable to fairly evaluate these officers' testimony and determine in this case that appellant was in fact guilty.
Further questions?
If there are no further questions, we respectfully request the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Does Mr. Smith have time left? All right, we'll give you 2 minutes. 30 seconds, you can hardly say anything.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the last point, I appreciate the court's comments. I do think this kind of argument is a recipe for wrongful convictions.
Other than the portion that was quoted by Chief Judge Jeff Garland, is the rest of it erroneous at all? Anything else that the prosecutor said, is there any other error that we take out that point?
That's the only part that we raised, Your Honor. However, it was raised three times, and it was done in rebuttal right before closing, so it was at the peak of the persuasive
and you didn't get a chance effect. To answer.
Yeah.
You were not trial counsel, I think.
I was not.
Right. Your Honor. And there wasn't an objection at the time, right?
It was not an objection at the time. But, yeah, I think this kind of argument has no place ever. In a trial.
I think the government has agreed that they. I think the government has agreed they'll advise their attorneys of these cases.
Right. Turning back to the first issue, just briefly, the fact that it was not scientifically impossible is not enough. It's their burden, not ours. Here there was, as Judge Pillard noted, basically a bare credibility finding, a conclusory. This court is left to guess as to why this mistake occurred. The district court doesn't have to get in someone's head, perhaps, but it does need to show that the witness was acting on facts leading sensibly to the conclusion of probability. This court can't review the findings below. How can you review why the person is deemed credible if there's no explanation of why the mistake happened and why the person was credible? What are the facts relied on here? There aren't any. This court needs to remand the case, the suppression issues on the October 21st stop. This is their burden. They did not meet their burden. That's why the court never made those factual findings below. A bare credibility finding is not sufficient. Subjective good faith is not enough. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, you were appointed by the court to represent the appellant. You've done an excellent job, and we're grateful for your assistance.